You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. In his latest book, Humanoids and High Strangeness, investigator, researcher and author Preston Dennett looks at 20 remarkable cases. They are all incredibly different in some aspects, and yet remarkably similar in others. We've greys riding bicycles, some werewolves hiding in closets, contactees having a lifelong series of experiences, and much, much more. It's an incredible collection that makes you realise just how unusual some experiences can be. Before that though, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. You can also click the link in the show notes as always. Thank you to each and everyone that continues to support the show through Patreon. It really is appreciated. You can find Mysteries and Monsters across all social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. Don't forget you can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com. For episodes, news, and merchandise, our intro and outro are performed by the incredible Weary Pines. Thank you as always to Dean Bestor for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brendan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange Network. As the cases in Preston's book show, we are ourselves humanoids of high strangeness, and it seems we are not alone. The topic of ufology may seem full of unusual cases that may appear strange, but just how strange is strange? In his new book, Humanoids and High Strangeness, 20 True UFO Encounters, Preston Dennett presents a selection of highly unusual encounters from around the world. Preston, welcome back!
For having me on. I appreciate it.
Hey, always nice to spend time in your company. I always feel enriched and enlightened after we've spoken.
I hope so. That's awesome.
So, I can't believe it's been over a year since we last spoke, when we dove into another one of your fabulous previous books, UFOs Over the Drive-In, which was a wonderful collection. And yet, here we are again, once again. Your book turns up. I can't believe how large it is. It's chock full of incredible cases. In your analysis, Preston, everything that you've been doing for nearly 40 years now, what takes a UFO case from just being unusual to being highly strange?
Well, that's a good question, because UFO encounters are practically by definition unusual, strange, certainly. Hmm. But they just seem to have levels and levels to them. And what I've noticed is that the more extensive an encounter is, the more high strangeness starts to occur. So if someone, a simple sighting is certainly thrilling, but when someone has face-to-face contact with humanoids or is taken on board, this is when we start to see quite a number of unusual things going on. And they go across the gamut. I mean, it can be anything from telepathic messages to all kinds of paranormal events, such as levitation or healing or out-of-body experiences, past life recall, seeing ghosts. It's really hard to define, actually, because that's one of the things about this subject, is that each case has unique elements to it that are difficult to categorize. And, I don't know how to answer that question, really.
Well, it is a peculiar thing, isn't it? Because, as you say, in their very DNA, really, any kind of UFO encounter is strange. There are always notable ones where people seem to have some kind of ongoing relationship with them or some of these. I'm amazed. One of the things that struck me looking at the 20 cases that are in the new book is the variety of the perception of the witnesses or the experiences, Preston, that some people view them in very different ways. Are you still surprised that people consider them to be angels or aliens or other kind of entities, even in this day and age? Or do you think that's just says more about their background and their upbringing than anything else?
Certainly that element. Having interviewed a lot of people, it's pretty clear that people view their experience through what I would call the lens of their belief system. And I see this all the time. People are trying and struggling to interpret what happened to them and may kind of turn to their own world experience, what they know about, and define it as perhaps a spiritual phenomena, angelic or demonic, or I mean, it goes right down the line. And I think a lot of stuff does get put under what I would call the UFO umbrella. That might not belong there. I mean, there's one case in the book involving a gentleman who saw what he's claims is an elf or, a gnome, something along these lines. And after interviewing him and kind of doing research into that topic, which I won't say I've shied away from, but I never really dived deep into it. I was shocked to find out how many cases there are, modern cases of people seeing not ETs, but elves, dwarves, gnomes, fairies, these kinds of things. And I asked him, I thought maybe this could be a what we would call screen memory, meaning, it was an ET, but just kind of gave him the impression that it wasn't and was perhaps something else. 'Cause we see that. Screen memories of owls and deer and all manners of entities. But having talked to him, no, I don't think it was an ET. I think this was exactly what it appears to be. Though hard to say for sure. But yeah, that's what's really interesting about these cases. And what I really wanted to highlight is that often it's not just ETs. People will experience perhaps spiritual phenomena. What there was at least a couple of cases in there where people saw angelic beings. One, a standard angel, as we would think of it, with wings and the whole deal. Another said that she encountered Mother Mary, an actual religious figure visitation. So super interesting. Ghosts, of course, come up all the time. Bigfoot as well. So there's a wide variety of stuff going on. And I think it's so important we talk about it because I'm learning that a lot of people don't. And when they share their encounter, they're leaving out some of the high strangeness aspects because they're not sure that they will be believed. And I got an example of this in the book when two young brothers from Texas described some very high strangeness events that were associated with their encounters. And one of the witnesses in the book from New York called me up afterwards and he says, "I'm so sorry I didn't tell you, but I read that chapter about the kids from Texas." And he said the same exact thing happened to me. Yeah, the high strangeness in that one, if I may,
Yes.
was, those two brothers were being visited by little blue beings, which I don't hear a whole lot. It's often grays, though I hear a wide variety, human-looking, praying mantis, tall whites, short little hairy dwarf-like beings. But the blue beings do come up, and they describe them in much the same way I've heard from other people, as being very short, wearing robes, kind of having flat faces, a bluish tint to their skin, small dark eyes, carrying little wands, and this sort of thing. At any rate, they would be visited not nightly, but certainly quite often, hundreds of times over a period of years. And here's the high strangeness part, which kind of just, I mean, it almost made me laugh because there's a humorous aspect to this. They would wake up in the morning wrapped up in their bed sheets, like a burrito, tightly wrapped, with their arms bound to their side, kind of, so tightly they couldn't get out. I mean, they had to call for their parents. And their parents are like, "How did you do this?" I said, "We didn't. It's the little blue men, Mom. We keep telling you." Now, their parents were religious and didn't really understand or believe in what was happening, even though there was physical evidence right there. So, yeah, that kept happening. And I had to laugh because I've heard that before. And that's when the guy from New York called me and said, you know what? I'm sorry I didn't tell you. And I'm honestly sorry I didn't ask because I didn't think to ask. But he said he would wake up with the same thing, his blankets wrapped tightly around him. That, and not in an accidental way, you know, where you're tossing and turning. I mean, tightly wrapped like a Tootsie Roll. So that is a high strangeness for you. And I have to think that's done on purpose. Perhaps as a calling card, kind of a joke, a little bit of a sense of humor to say, hey, we were here. I don't know, but it sure is odd.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it is a very odd case in general. I mean, the way that they describe the creatures seem to be, it's almost as if they're hopping. They say that their movements seem quite jerky and hoppy, and that the fact that they're wearing clothes as well, which is not something that gets noticed a lot, Preston, and when they're covering these kind of things. But it's also interesting that they seem quite, I wouldn't say naive, but as they grow older, they begin to feel a bit more scared about what's going on, which is an interesting development. You would think that perhaps they'd be used to it as they grew, but the opposite seems to happen.
And that's a common pattern, actually. As young kids, I think we are not familiar with something that is might be strange. We don't interpret it. We don't look at this and say, wow, that's different, because we have no life experience. And they don't know what the idea of ETs even is. So seeing something that's super different might not necessarily cause a fear reaction. Whereas as time goes on and you start to realize, well, these are not normal people. This is different. And in fact, when they saw the Star Wars movie franchise and also The Wizard of Oz, they became quite frightened by the little munchkins or the little Ewoks in the Star Wars movie, and realized, yeah, this was strange. But what I do find is, yeah, there's that sort of phase, I guess, that stage where fear does mount. But as their encounters continue, often they get past that. Usually, I should say. And they realize, no, they're not here to hurt us. But yeah, it is often very scary, usually starting around puberty or so, or as a person grows into a young adult. But once they reach adulthood, and or if their encounters continue, which they usually do, they start to realize that, you know, they're okay with this. Perhaps they were healed or given a tour of the craft or given messages of some kind that are positive.
Do you often get experiences like the brothers here that have experiences that continue all their way into their adult life? I know I've heard some people say that when children have experiences such as this, Preston, they will get to a certain age and then they seem to stop for whatever reason. Or in your personal experience, is their experience more of the norm that it continues into their life? Because I know they continue seeing them into their adult years.
I mean, there's sort of a bell curve, I guess I would say, because there are some people who've had childhood experiences and then it ends, or they perceive it to end, when perhaps it is continuing, but they've just sort of locked it away and explain away any experiences that would fit under that category because they don't want to deal with it. And so they live a normal life. On the other hand, there are some who do have experiences throughout life, but it's very infrequent. So it might just be three or four throughout their entire life. And others who have a real, well, I guess, a bad case of the UFOs. It just, you know, it's chronic. It keeps coming back over and over and over. And there are some, and there's a few in this book, where people just had what I would call a one-off, just one experience, or maybe one or two right next to each other, which is more the exception than the rule. Because, yeah, if it's starting at early childhood, chances are there's going to be numerous events. And it does go in phases as well, because people will go for years without an experience, and then suddenly it starts up again, and There's a period of real intense activity, and then it quiets down for a while. Usually at some point it does sort of taper off, particularly towards old age. But even that's not necessarily true.
How do people who have had the one incident often feel as they go forward with their life, Preston? Do they fall into two categories of, well, something very odd happened to me and it was amazing, or something really old happened to me, I want to see it again, I need to see it again?
Yeah, that does often happen. But sometimes not. I mean, there was one gentleman in the book. I love his case. He's a professional businessman. He was a manager of the largest bank in Argentina, a commercial pilot. So my point is, he's a great witness, but had never had experiences with UFOs, only had a passing interest. He'd heard about them and wondered, as a pilot, you know, how do they fly? How do they go from star system to star system? But in 2015, when a wave of sightings occurred near his hometown in San Juan, Argentina, he became a little bit intrigued and wanted to reach out and make contact. So he kind of just took his car out to the outskirts of the city where there weren't any lights and went looking for UFOs, you know, brought his camera and flashlight and binoculars and so forth, and was really disappointed when nothing showed up. But I think just that simple act of sort of looking for them and reaching out and thinking about them ignited something, because this is a pattern we see. You reach out to them, they will reach out to you. Because that night, he went to bed, woke up at 3 a.m. and heard someone calling his name. His name is Hector. And he heard it over and over again, telepathically in his mind, a male voice just saying, Hector, jumped out of bed. And he says, I don't know why, but I ran to the window. And looking out the window, he saw a UFO, a bright orange white light streaking across the sky. Now, as a trained observer, a pilot, he saw instantly that this wasn't a shooting star. It was far too slow, but certainly not a plane or helicopter or balloon, because it was far too fast for that. And of course, there was the added complication that he believes whoever was inside that thing called him to the window, called his name, woke him up. So that's how it began for him. And he was very much intrigued and wanted another experience. And he got one. Boy, did he ever. Yeah, it was 2 months or so later that he was in his bedroom and woke up because the room was filling with light, and became very, very frightened when he saw two beings, tall beings, you know, 5 and a half, one of them, the other was 6 feet tall, standing in his doorway. And these were not quite typical grays, though shared some features. They did have large bald heads. And he said a kind of grayish skin, were wearing blue jumpsuits, greenish blue jumpsuits with no insignia or anything, but they have red collars, a red belt, and red cuffs, and large dark eyes, and really quite frightened him. But at that point, they said, you don't need to be afraid. We have not come to hurt you. And he says his fear just left. And instead, he felt this incredible wave of love coming from them, really strong. He said it was a love like never before, is how he put it. And it caused him to start crying with just emotion, especially when one of these, the shorter one, walked up to his bedside and did something really unusual, kind of cradled his head in his arms and said, we have come to heal you. And gave him this little brown triangular shaped pill and told him to eat it, which he did. He said it was quite bitter, but he ate it. And really, that's all he remembers. He doesn't remember seeing them leave, but he remembers waking up. Certainly the next morning, there were tears still, you know, dried on his face and his pillow. And he was slightly nauseous and would be for about a week afterwards. But absolutely believes he had contact. And that was enough for him. He started doing research. I mean, it changed his life for sure. But he wanted to see them, he saw them, and now he's good with that.
Well, that is a very interesting aspect to it, because often we don't get that kind of emotional response to an experience of being overcome with emotion, Preston. Often people will say that they have a conversation or anything, but I'm not aware of too many cases where somebody's cradled by an entity.
Correct. Yeah, I don't have a lot quite like that, but I will say a number of people have described that feeling of overwhelming love coming from these beings. I mean, I've heard that quite often, and they always describe it in ways like, this was more than the love I felt for my wife when we got married or when I held my child for the first time. I struggle to find the depth of emotion that's coming from these beings. In fact, there was another guy in the book who described that as well, just this intense love for the being that he saw.
Well, that's the Sebastian's experience, who lives in Peru. That one is a very odd encounter on numerous levels, because he's suffering from some real stress in his personal life. He's got financial worries, he's worrying about things. And then he has this strange encounter that completely seems to, as we've said earlier, completely seems to change his life, Preston, for the better. And it's almost as if he needed to have that experience for him to sort of shake himself out of his stupor and move forward with his life.
Yeah, it's so fascinating because I have noticed that pattern with other cases. There's few in the book, certainly, where people are at a point in their lives where they're having real difficulty, perhaps depressed or having a life crisis of some kind. And that's when their encounter occurs, which is super interesting to me because I think that's beyond coincidence or synchronicity. It seems intentional. And that was certainly true with Sebastian Bulos, who was such a delight to interview, because he gave sort of a different cultural perspective. So many cases come from, the US. That's what I loved about, the cases in this book is, there's one from England, one from France, Germany, I mean, all over the world, Australia, Canada, and of course, South America. And he was very vehement, very emotional. Very intelligent as well, super psychic. Well, after his encounters, he certainly was. But yeah, like you said, had been really struggling. He was a young man. This was fairly recent too, 2011, and had lost his job and was financially struggling and really trying to find a job and had run out of money to the point where he had to stop eating meat, which he says in Peru was just not easy to do because they love their barbecue. So what happened was a very interesting experience. He was out hanging laundry. Actually, I think this was 2012 or thereabouts, and suddenly got this vision in his head, what we might describe as remote viewing or clairvoyance, I guess. But he saw this orange glowing craft, or what he perceived to be a craft. He's like, well, this is odd because he's looking down on it from above and he can see the city of Lima where he lived. He's like, well, look, that's not far from where I live. In fact, it's just north of me. And so he's thinking, well, what could this possibly mean? And it was moving towards his location. And he's like, well, this might appear at any moment because it's coming towards me. And that's when he got it. And this is the weird high strangeness. He got a telepathic message that was very clear, speaking in Spanish, his primary language, which said, Mira el cielo, which in English means, look up, look at the sky, which of course he did. And he saw something very unusual. It was this craft, which was glowing orange, and inside of it, there was this tall, muscular figure, a male, which instantly reminded him of a very famous painting by Leonardo da Vinci called The Vitruvian Man.
Yes.
Yeah, you may remember that with the male figure's arms stretched out and the legs kind of wide. And he says it was very much like that. But this beautiful, muscular man, with a very narrow waist, long arms and legs, and he said, as soon as he saw this, he says he felt this intense feeling of love. And it's almost as if this guy was a long-lost friend. And he says, couldn't tell if it was dressed or not. It was mostly just a silhouette. But love was pouring forth from this figure to the point where he almost felt his chest lifting and aching as this craft came over him. And as it got really close, he did get a little scared, started screaming, UFO, UFO, and running around crazy. And finally called his friend out who lived in the same house. Her name was Alejandra, to come outside. And she's like, what are you doing? You're going crazy. And by this point, this craft is already moving off. And he's like, look. And he watched her face change as she realized, oh my gosh, this is a UFO. Now, she didn't get to see this figure, but she confirmed his sighting, which is good for him because it's very stressful for a witness to go through something like this alone. So he got confirmation, but the strangeness wasn't done yet. They went inside and he turns and looks out the window and it's dark. This is impossible. It was light when they went inside. And so he freaked out and realized that he had missing time. So that was his first incident, which led to just incident after incident of high strangeness.
Yeah, there's an interesting precursor to all this as well, is that he tells the experience of seeing the lead singer of one of his favorite bands, and they just randomly sit down for a conversation, and it seems quite spiritual. It's almost as if he was being prepared for it, Preston. Is that how Sebastian views it, perhaps looking backwards?
Yeah, that was a weird synchronicity for sure. He got to meet, by chance, I guess, the lead singer of a very popular band, Café Tacuba. And he was a huge fan. And it turned out that the lead singer, Ruben is his name, was a very spiritual guy and was talking all about, 2012 and the Mayan calendar and that there would be big changes coming to the world and all humanity. And said to Sebastian that you have to be prepared. And it really got him thinking. So yeah, I do think that there are weird synchronicities. That was something I felt was important to put in the book because he certainly made a point of it.
I think sometimes when you have a situation or a conversation like that, Preston, it's easy to overlook it, but clearly it struck him because of who he had it with. And when I read his encounter, that it really struck me as though that conversation was meant to happen. For whatever reason, that was meant to happen and set him on this path, as we've said, that really pulled his life out from the gutter and got himself clambering back forwards where he was taking a more positive outlook on everything.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've talked to a lot of other people who've remarked upon weird, strange synchronicities. I've certainly experienced it myself, meeting witnesses under very unusual circumstances or being pulled into something that will lead to an important event. So yeah, that happens all the time in this field. In fact, there is a lot of witnesses I've talked to, quite a few actually, who met their lifelong partner in life through unusual circumstances, only to find out that they're both contactees. So almost as if there's some sort of ET dating service out there pulling them together. I'm only being half facetious because
Yes,
honestly, it
no.
keeps coming up.
Yeah. I have noticed that there does seem to be a real, I suppose, for a lot of people, as we were saying about Sebastian having his friend there able to witness it, Preston. I suppose if you are in a normal family unit and you are the only person who sees something and you have such a profound response to what happens, it must be extremely difficult because often people will be told that they misidentified something, perhaps they're hallucinating, perhaps their medication might be playing up. A lot of people aren't very open to supporting someone that's had such an experience. So If you, by some design or cosmic alignment, end up meeting someone that is of the same mindset and has had a similar experience, it would make sense that these people would be attracted to each other on that level, if nothing else.
You're darn lucky if that happens, because this can split up families.
Yes.
I mean, it certainly caused some havoc in my own family when I was simply investigating this stuff. And you know, I have quite a few brothers and sisters, three older brothers, an older sister, and a younger sister. And a couple of my brothers thought I'd lost my mind. And my dad certainly did. Never believed it to the day he died that, you know, that this was something real. And yeah, this will split up couples, certainly. And, well, there was one gentleman I interviewed who was driving along the 5 freeway in the Central Valley of Southern California.
Mm.
This was in the late 1970s with a friend late at night and came upon this UFO landing alongside the freeway. Now, mind you, this is a remote area, not a lot of traffic. And as they approached it, they were discussing, you know, what could this be? Is this a crop dusting helicopter? It had multicolored lights all over it, this weird fog surrounding it. And as they drew up next to it, they realized, well, this isn't anything normal. And it sent down a beam of light, which struck their car. And he has vague memories of being pulled out of the car and on board. Nothing he can really, you know, describe in any detail.
Mm.
But the next thing he knows is he's not driving anymore. His friend is. They're so dazed that they can't even speak about it to each other. But did realize that they had missing time, and it completely changed his life. He ended up leaving his girlfriend. He quit his job. He moved out of his home. Ended up going to Hawaii and living off in the wilderness and stocking up food in a cave and preparing for the end times. No kidding.
Wow.
So that's how profoundly this can affect a person. And certainly not only with their life, but their psyche. People will describe being absolutely psychically awakened in a wide variety of ways. So very, very profoundly affects people.
Have you often come across cases like that, Preston, where somebody's driving the car and when they come round, they're not anymore? I've heard of a few cases like that. Probably the Berkshire UFO incident is a great example of that. Tom Reed, who was on the episode of Unsolved Mysteries a couple of years ago on Netflix, was talking about the thing that struck them was that his mother and his grandmother swapped places in the car. So, whoever was in the driver's seat couldn't actually drive. And they were like, hang on a minute, what's going on here?
Yeah, I personally have only run across that a few times, but certainly I know of many, many cases in the literature. And I have many other cases where people are perhaps returned to the wrong bed.
Mm-hmm.
Or put in the bed with their head at the foot of their bed and their feet on their pillow or even outside. I mean, there's one case in this book. Well, I think there's a few actually, but one comes to mind where a young girl from North Carolina was having encounters, not fully aware of it, but remembered seeing unusual looking beings looking in through her bedroom window and such, but kept waking up outside. And the door was locked, and she's like, how am I getting out here? This is impossible. So I think, honestly, because I've wondered about this, is this a mistake, or are they doing this on purpose, or are they even aware of it? I think I have to believe they're aware of it, because I mean, these are guys who can build craft, which travel between star systems and heal people and do all these amazing things. And I'm guessing, I'm purely speculating, but I suspect that they're doing this on purpose for the same reason that they might roll up someone inside their blanket so tightly that they have a little bit of trouble getting out, as a way of letting them know that this happened.
Mm.
Here's a clue. This is why you're waking up with your head at the foot of the bed, or you know, standing on your doorstep trying to get in.
Or some some of them could just have a very strange sense of humor, Preston.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to not going to discount it. I just read about a case, I think it was this morning, where a lady was pulled on board and had a wig, and they pulled it off, and one of them tried the wig on and kind of looked at the other. And she's like, well, they must have a sense of humor. I thought it was funny.
That's brilliant. That's brilliant. I don't think I've ever heard of an alien trying a wig on. I suppose you would, though, as well, because often we hear cases where that the thing about what makes these creatures seem unusual is their lack of hair, Preston. So I suppose to them, hair is, pardon the pun, a completely alien concept to them, to a lot of them.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure if I go that far, but yeah, definitely a lot don't have hair. Mm. But I do believe there was a case from England, Peter Huff, I think it
yes.
was a researcher who interviewed a lady by the name of Glenda who had an ET show up wearing a wig.
Yes.
And I do know of other cases where they come and visit people and they're dressed up in perhaps a suit. You know, Whitley Strieber described that. Mm-hmm. I've had at least three cases myself where people described ETs wearing clothes, our clothes. I mean, there's one case in the book where a lady had a very strange encounter when she was, gosh, I think 12 years old or so, and was outside in her neighborhood in, well, no, she was 10 years old. This was in Woodland Hills, California. And she was just bicycling around in the morning with her neighborhood friends and was at the top of this tall driveway and going to race them home. She was alone when this little boy came riding out on a bicycle out of a grove of trees from pretty much nowhere. I mean, there's no street up there. And he was wearing a Pendleton button-down shirt and blue jeans and drove right up to her. Not well, by the way. He could barely ride the bike. And as he got real close, she realized this guy is either deformed or he's not human. Well, he wasn't human. It was a gray. Mm. She gave a typical description. Though at age 10, of course, she didn't know what a gray was and wouldn't for years. But yeah, very large, bald head, dark, dark eyes, almost no nose or mouth, three or four rather long fingers. And it reached, it came right up to her, got off its bike, reached out and touched her shoulder and said, "You don't need to be afraid," which, of course, absolutely freaked her out.
Yes.
Her response was, "Why are you telling me I don't need to be afraid? Apparently there's something I need to be afraid of."
Yeah.
She ended up having missing time. And years later, when this subject started being portrayed in the media, she saw a gray on TV. She's like, "Oh, my gosh, that looks exactly like that," what she called him, the freak boy or the monster boy.
Mm.
She never knew. But that was her introduction to the phenomena. And I wonder about that because that's different.
Yeah.
I have not heard that before. But I'm guessing it was an attempt to sort of reduce the fear factor. We're like, you know, let's bring him down on a little bike. Let's have him bike up to her and hopefully that she won't completely freak out.
I mean, to be honest, I think that would have the opposite effect. I mean, what?
Which it did, yeah.
I mean, is it a case of, I can't understand why they would think that would be a good idea, Preston, to be honest. Fair enough, if you're going to dress up as a human, fine, but still remain as a grey, I think people might find that even stranger.
Oh, well, she certainly did. And I think the problem is we as humans are so incredibly fearful. We're steeped in it. I mean, it's in our media. We're in effect trained to fear, which is really unfortunate. I mean, and this is one of the causes of so much discrimination and, you know, all the problems we're having on our planet right now can be directly linked to just fear of people that look different.
Yeah.
Which is so unfortunate because I don't think the ETs intend to scare people at all.
Mm.
I think they're having a real hard time with it. And in fact, that's what many contactees have told me, that they are doing the best they can to not scare people. but it's on us because we're the ones who are having that reaction.
Mm.
In fact, the first thing they will always tell you is don't be afraid, almost without exception. If you have face-to-face contact, I bet you the first things they're going to say to you is have no fear. Don't be afraid. You will not be harmed. No harm will come to you. We're not here to hurt you. Something along those lines.
Is it often the case, because one of the other cases that you look into here, which is Pamela, who has a sighting that's brought on by hearing her children screaming because there's a UFO hovering above them outside, and that seems to basically take her back to where her experiences began. As you've just been mentioning about the strange creature on the bike, is it something that some people have a later experience that then unlocks everything else, Preston, that they've basically had a screen memory or they've suppressed it for whatever reason, and it's only in their later life that something else happens, which is actually a continuation of their experiences, that makes them realize, actually, this has been going on for a lot longer than I realized?
Yeah, 100%. That is a very prominent pattern. And of course, I'm going to go back to the bell curve again, because I do have many cases of people I've interviewed who wake up as young teenagers, perhaps, or have been okay with it their whole lives. Or on the other hand, who are much later in life, middle-aged or even later, then have a very traumatic encounter and realize, oh my gosh, this has been going on my whole life. I mean, there's one guy who was, let's see, he was young, 23 years old, had a gray walk into his room and was going up to his young infant son. And he jumps up and says, you're not taking my son. I'm going with you. And he said it was almost like a near-death experience, because seeing this gray, he recognized him as a friend, as a teacher.
Mm.
And he was very strict Mormon religion. And suddenly, you know, having this encounter opened the floodgates to about 5 or 10 encounters throughout his childhood, which he had denied or explained away or were camouflaged under screen memories. I mean, there was one time he remembered being chased down the mountain by a herd of skunks, which he always thought was very peculiar.
Yes.
Of course, it wasn't skunks. It was the grays. And he remembered a full-on onboard encounter. But that's true with Pamela, who, you know, as a young woman, was 22 years old or so. This was 1975, I believe. And heard her kids screaming. Well, one was a cousin, one was her child. And ran outside. Bright, sunny morning, by the way. And there was this beautiful, enormous, classic flying saucer right in the front of the house, right over the tree. The kids are screaming. It's not that high up. Her brother is just staring at it, absolutely speechless. And she goes running towards the kids, freaking out. And they're running towards her. She basically goes right under this thing by the time she gets her kids. They all run back into the house, and it darts off shortly later. But all she's thinking is, oh, not again. I remember this. In fact, she remembered many encounters of seeing UFOs. Once it followed her home as a very young girl. And she called into the house, and her father came out, and he saw it too. She had a few of those sightings. But then, at age 14, I think this was 1967, this was in Maine, Dresden, Maine, she was in her bedroom when something came through the wall. And she said, Preston, I honestly didn't know what it was because I'd never heard of grays, and it could have been the devil for all I knew, is how she put it. Of course, it was your classic grays, short little guys with bald heads, large dark eyes, gray skin, very thin bodies. And they pulled her out of bed. And they said, you don't need to be afraid, but you need to come with us. She didn't want to, but she said she really didn't feel like she was able to resist. And they pulled her through the wall. And there on the street, parked right in front of her house, is this saucer. And she's thinking, well, hope no cars come by because they're not going to be able to get by. And pulled her on board. She said it was quite cool inside the craft. And She went and looked out the window and was shocked to see that already they were in outer space. And looking down, she could see the planet Earth far, far below her. And they asked her if she wanted to go with them. And she's like, no, I just want to go home. She has some memories of being physically examined, though she's not very clear on that. She does remember there was a good number of these little guys on board, 6, 7, 8 maybe. But one of them was much taller. They were about 4 feet, 3 to 4 feet. One was closer to 5, 5.5, and looked partly human. So probably a hybrid, perhaps, half human, half gray, because we do see that. And it was wearing sort of a cotton dress and seemed to be very interested in what was going on. Never really spoke. There wasn't a whole lot of communication going on. She just kept saying, I want to go home. And they said, you will. We just need a few more minutes. We're almost done. And basically returned her. That's all. Next thing she knows, she remembers waking up and instantly did tell her parents. And her mom, who didn't like the subject, didn't want to hear it and was skeptical. But her dad, who of course had seen a UFO with her and who was in the military and was familiar with the subject and had prior sightings, absolutely believed her, which gave her quite a bit of comfort. But again, it wasn't years until she fully embraced it. Her sister would later have an encounter out in the woods. She became very psychic following this, having lots of precognition and some later real interesting encounters.
I'm intrigued about the one she sees with her boyfriend, that she has numerous ones, but the one where they're in the yard, she just said that she had a really bad feeling about it, as though this one felt different for whatever reason, Preston.
Yeah, I think seeing something that close is really disconcerting, because what people realize at this point is that it is coming for them. This is not a random event. And I think she started to realize at that point, because, I mean, they had a ball of light enter into their room and it was darting around and thinking, you know, what is this? What is going on? And when one came outside their house, she's like, you know what? I'm going back inside. I don't know about you. But she did have another incident, which I thought was very interesting, where she was out in the front yard and a craft came very slow, very low, right over her, humming, making this kind of low humming noise. And she was rooted to the spot. She says, honestly, I can't tell you if that was the effect of my own fear or the craft itself, but it was close enough where, you know, it's cliche, but you could throw a rock and hit it. And finally, she had been waiting outside because her son was visiting a friend and was kind of late. He's supposed to be back by now. And she goes inside and tells her husband, and he's like, why didn't you call me? She said, I'm sorry, I couldn't. I was rooted to the spot. But goes back outside, and that's when her son comes running up and says, Mom, you're never going to guess what I saw. She knows. She could guess because she saw it. And of course, he describes the same exact craft. So I cannot believe that that's coincidental. I think it showed itself to both her and her son intentionally. And as you know, this is something that is often generational. So if you have encounters, it's highly likely you have a parent or grandparent that will. And of course, it goes on to your children. And there's one case in the book, actually, that involved 4 generations, all who had an experience at the exact same age of 7. So it's just an interesting takeaway there.
Especially, this seems, it's not just Pamela as well. This seems to be one of those series of encounters that, as you mentioned, Preston, is affecting more than just the immediate family as well, because obviously we've got the sister, we've got the cousin. This, right. Whatever's going on, I'm not really aware of one having such a large set of goals in regards to a family. Often we'll hear about parents and children, or parents, children and grandparents even, but when it starts to affect sisters and cousins and things, that's a new one on me.
Yeah, well, it's not terribly unusual, actually. And I think it's, you got to take it on a case-by-case basis. But it's not unusual for every member of the family to have encounters. And on the other hand, it's not unusual for members of the family of a contactee to not have a single encounter. I know in Whitley Strieber's case, some of his family members never saw anything. I believe his brother did have a gray walk into the room once. But that was not a lot of bleed through there. They seem to focus largely on one person in a lot of cases. But in Pamela's case, yeah, I think at some point, pretty much every member of the family had seen something. And in fact, just recently, her son said that he had praying mantis type ETs come into his room, and his wife saw them as well. So her daughter-in-law. yeah, there's a lot of variation there, and it's a case-by-case thing, but sometimes it's just one person in the family. Sometimes it's a couple, perhaps twin brothers and sisters, or twins will both have encounters, almost always if they're twins. But yeah, sometimes it's just a couple in the family.
The Richard Barton case, which is the alien in the red vest, made me chuckle, primarily because of this strange sort of peeping Tom-like behavior this creature seems to have when it first makes itself known to him. He tries playing a staring game with it, and he can't get his head around. He knows what it's not, but he doesn't know what it is, which I find a fascinating description of how it starts for him.
Yeah, that was a very interesting case. One of my favorite for sure, because I don't know that I've ever heard anything quite like it. But I will say this is sort of the weird introduction they sometimes make with children in a way that's just slightly at arm's length. And with Richard Barton, this was 1965, West Corners, New York. He's 4 years old. The first time, he's sitting in the living room watching TV. His sister's in another room, his younger sister. His dad's at work. His mom is in the kitchen. When he swore he saw someone looking at him through the window, but turned to look, and of course, whoever it was dropped down so fast, he couldn't see them. And after three or four times of this, he's like, that's enough. My friends are playing a trick on me. I don't know what's going on. And it couldn't be his friends, even though he thought so, because the window was a little bit too high for, you know, someone of that age, 4, 5, 6, to really peer inside, unless they were standing on each other's shoulders or something, just kind of what he was thinking. So finally, he just goes to the window and does a very kid thing. This actually made me laugh, too, when he described it. He stuck his thumbs in his ears, stuck his tongue out, and started wiggling his fingers, kind of nanu, 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 like a little kid will do.
Yeah.
Don't stick your tongue out at somebody. And he said as soon as he did that, this, well, what he now knows is a gray, but at the time he sure didn't, this being pops up right on the other side of the window. Mind you, this is not across the street or anything. This is right next to the window, a foot or two away, and stares right at him. And he's absolutely dumbstruck because he can see this has large dark eyes, gray skin, a different nose, a slit for a mouth, large head, bald, you know, the typical description in most ways, kind of angry looking expression is how he described it. Which is something I've heard before, sort of deep furrows around the eyes. But most unusual was wearing this sort of red, dark red sleeveless vest with this weird symbol on it, which turned out to be significant later. But he stared at it for a good 5 or 10 seconds and realized, well, this is not human, and screamed, ran to the kitchen and dragged his mom into the living room. Of course, by then it's gone. He's not going to go to the window, but pushes her up to it. And she looks out and says, honey, there's nothing there. What did you see? And he doesn't know what to tell her. So he says, I saw a wolf in a red vest. She's like, honey, what? And she can see he's telling the truth. He's very emotional. And of course, that spread through the whole family and everyone's talking about it. You know, Bobby saw this werewolf looking being. At any rate, he saw this being and they thought it would be a one-off, but it wasn't. It happened again at least a half dozen times. Enough times where there was a few times he absolutely ignored it. But there was one occasion where he's like, you know what? I'm going to do a staring contest with this thing. I'm not going to run away this time. And he was there. It was always in the same room, the living room. And sensed this being looking through the window again, you know, that feeling you get when someone's looking at you, and ran up to the window, did his thing, stuck his tongue out. And this being, of course, pops up. And he's staring at it. It's not blinking. He's not blinking. He's just gonna stare at this thing and does it for a good 20 seconds. But he said, Preston, it's too hard. It gets really scary once you realize how close you are to something not human. And of course, he didn't tell anyone that time because he didn't want all the to-do that happened, all the reactions. But this was a precursor to a major onboard encounter where he was, and he remembers this consciously, by the way. This is not recalled under hypnosis, but does recall being taken on board with his mom and sister. His sister was really too young to be able to remember it. And his mom was absolutely out of it, in a trance, and has no recall. But he does remember being separated from them, very upset about that. And they said, don't worry, we'll take you to your mom when you're done, when you are done. Took him into another room, physically examined him. He heard them talking and became quite alarmed when one of them said, well, there's a problem here. He has a medical problem. He might not be able to be part of this program. Now, this wasn't terribly scary for him, but somewhat uncomfortable, like a doctor's visit. And that did scare him until one of them says, you know what? I don't think it's going to be a problem. This probably won't manifest until he's well past childbearing age. So he's a little bit older now. So I mean, he understands this. He's got a photographic memory, really good memory. And he felt a little bit better about it. But then they said, okay, we're done. And he's thinking, okay, well, you're going to take me to see my mom now. And they said, no, we'll take you to her when she's done. And then he got angry because that's not what they said. They said, we will take you to her when you're done. Well, he's done and they're not taking him to her. They're saying, we'll take you to her when she's done. And so, well, they're giving me the runaround. But long story short, they finally took him to another room where she was. The floor turned transparent and down they went in this beam of light onto the ground. And that's all he really remembers. But wakes up the next morning very late, which is so unlike him because he's a very early riser and likes to watch his dad go off to work. And he thought, well, I guess they're letting me sleep in because the spacemen came last night and the police are going to be here and the government and everyone's going to be talking about this. Of course, nobody was, and nobody remembered a darn thing, which was another thing that really freaked him out. But he would have later encounters.
I find it strange that obviously his younger sister has her own set of experiences, which seem very different to what he was experiencing as well, because she seems to describe encounters with a werewolf type creature as well as strange things with her toys, which she dismisses as a dream. But obviously, Robert remembers seeing her on the ship as well. So, was it just a dream? And if so, it's a very strange thing to start dreaming about.
Yeah, well, Robert remembers her telling him about this and remembers her saying it a bit differently, that her toys would come to life and were poking and prodding her medically. And she doesn't really recall that, or does remember something of that, does remember seeing this being coming out of her brother's room. And yeah, describes it as a werewolf, which I suspect is kind of a screen memory. That's when someone, and I'm not sure I'm going to entirely put this on the ETs, because when someone sees something that they cannot categorize, that is absolutely and literally alien to their worldview, they overlay it again with their belief system. And so I'm guessing that the only thing she could possibly relate this to is, monsters, werewolves, things like this. Because she does remember details that are very much your classic encounter type descriptions, particularly it having very long fingers or pointing a rod at her and causing her to collapse and be unable to move, putting her back in bed. Later, she would have a very, very scary encounter with what she believes are reptilian beings coming in through the wall, which she felt were trying to steal her soul. Which I think is a product of just intense fear, perhaps. I don't have any good evidence that that is their goal at all. But, this was her experience. She certainly has the freedom and, the right to interpret it. It's her experience. So I'm certainly not going to say that's not what happened to you, because I can't. I don't have that right. But I wonder about it. Having talked to so many people, I know that when you are in intense fear, when you're at a level of panic that makes you absolutely, unable to control your fear, you're a very poor observer. And it's easily to label it as a negative experience because no one wants to be terrified out of their minds. So I suspect there's an element of that going on with her. But her case, her side of the story is super interesting because she also, like her brother, described some very intense psychic experiences. She was once contacted by the spirit of a murdered child who basically told her who the murderer was, who she later saw on TV and was convicted. And I looked it all up. I vet any witness and their story to the ability that I can. So what she's talking about did happen in terms of, this crime. So certainly a very interesting and complex case, which ended up involving their parents as well, and other family members.
It's interesting that she believes that they were coming for her soul, because I know there's one incident where Robert seems to think there's some kind of skeleton monster living in his closet, and when he tells his mum about it, she says, "Oh, well, it's a demon," and she calls the Baptist ministry.
Right. I find that interesting because, he did later find other very similar descriptions. And gosh, I forget the name of the magazine, but it's published in England, actually. Not Fate, but 14 times? Yeah, I think that's it. But at any rate, what really interested me about that particular aspect of his experiences is that these beings were coming out of the closet. Because that is so often what I hear in terms of ETs visiting someone in their room. They come out of the closet. And it's a rare contactee that doesn't have this fear of the closet or monsters in the closet. So when I heard that, I'm like, wow, heard that a million times. They come. I think they almost use it as a location where they can come into someone's room and perhaps have a little bit of safety net there in terms of not coming right into somebody, running into them directly. I don't know. I'm just speculating here, but I hear it so often that there has to be a reason ETs are using closets.
Yeah, it's almost like they're using it as a defense, so they can make sure everything is as they hope before they then make their entrance into the room, Preston, rather than just sort of appearing next to somebody's bed when they might not be fully asleep.
I mean, there's another case in the book, same darn thing. A kid was having experiences in North Carolina, and the grays would always come in through the closet. So.
Are you still surprised by some of the cases that come forward on this
Oh,
subject, Preston?
yeah, I absolutely am. And it's funny because I've been doing this for a pretty long time now. It's well over 35 years. It's almost we're pushing 40 now. 38 years that I've been doing this. And I think that by this point you would have heard everything. But it's just not the case. Every now and then another person comes along and just knocks me over. I mean, for example, last time we spoke about the driving theater encounters, I had no idea that that was a thing. And just before that, I had done a book on schoolyard encounters, where these objects, these ETs, these UFOs are hovering over schools and landing next to them. I'd heard of the Rua Zimbabwe case, certainly in Westall High School in Australia, and Broadhaven in Wales, and others, but not 100 of them. And I've got closer to 200. I just found another one this morning going through the MUFON journal. I'm like, oh my gosh, this was a school in Kentucky back in the 1970s. So yeah, I still continually get surprised. And that's what I really wanted to embrace in this book was just bring out all the high strangeness. Let's lay it out because I know other people are experiencing all these events. And it's time we just talk about it because that's how we're going to get to the bottom of all this. It's the only way we'll get to the bottom of this. You cannot censor a person's account and expect to solve any mysteries.
And of course, as well as always, by publishing these collections that often are overlooked for a variety of reasons, Preston, it creates a sense of safety for somebody who's had a similar experience because it allows them to know you are already open to their experience. It may be slightly different to one that you've reported or written about in one of your books, but you've already shown a breadth of acceptance that no experience is off the table. You, as you were saying about Robert's sister, you're not trying to explain her experience, you're saying what she said to you, and therefore that's how it is, bones and all. You're not trying to interpret into something that fits what you want it to be.
Just so important because I do see that with other researchers who have a theory, perhaps, or something they want to prove. Even an agenda that they feel like this is how you can explain the UFO phenomenon, they're going to find the cases that fit that. It's what I would call cherry picking and shoe fitting. And that's just plain and simple, not good science. Because, like statistics, you can march it out and any case that supports your theory or twist the numbers to support your narrative. But I don't know how useful that is because that leaves a lot by the wayside. And like you said, so many people are having these experiences that I think it behooves us all to really let the witness tell their story because they're the ones who know what's happening. Certainly not our government. I would not look to them for answers. Our governments, or the scientists on TV who have all these opinions about UFOs, but have never read a UFO book or talked to a witness or had an experience. They're just maybe an astronomer, so they think they know about UFOs. First, you have to study it. But yeah, I mean, some very odd experiences. One case that I really like occurred to a gentleman by the name of Andy Daly, and he lived in or lives in Warwickshire, England, and had this really interesting experience at 8 years old, January 8, 1980, his birthday, where he decided, he had woken up early and was feeling a little lonely and crawled into bed with his dad to wait for morning and had left the door open. It was slightly ajar and suddenly heard something rattling the doorknob. He's not asleep, by the way. He's just laying there and sees the doorknob moving and a shadow on the wall of something short, which comes in through the door. And why it's rattling the doorknob, who knows? Because the door is already open. But it does and comes through the door and it's nothing normal. He says it looked like a demonic ape. It was covered with hair from head to foot. Had sharp teeth, dark eyes, an oversized head. And he's thinking, is this real? Of course it's real. He can see the shadow on the wall of this thing. It's moving the door. It's staring right at him. He's petrified. He's too scared to even move or talk. And he's kind of just nudging his dad, thinking, wake up, wake up, wake up, wake up. And finally, he just can't take it and closes his eyes and thinking, just go away, just go away. And opens his eyes, and of course, it's not going away. It's still staring at him and really caused a kind of fear that was overwhelming to the point that he wasn't sure he was going to survive it. I mean, this is bone-chilling fear. People have a real hard time describing this, but they're like, it's a fear they've never felt before. It's all-encompassing. But finally, to his great relief, this being, whatever it was, backs up, kind of closes the door slightly, and leaves, at which point he jumps on his dad and wakes him up, tells him, and his dad's like, son, you just had a dream, you're okay. Of course, there's nothing in the house at this point. But we went over and over this experience, because he certainly thought about it for the rest of his life. And I asked him, what do you think this was? And he's like, well, I was hoping you could tell me. So we went over it, discussing the possibility that this was some sort of a demonic spirit. And we both kind of rejected that because it's very solid. And having studied that, that's really not how they manifest. It's a completely different thing, and it's very rarely a one-off. By that, I mean there would be all kinds of poltergeist-like activity and other stuff going on in the house that's quite dark. And that just wasn't the case. I thought, well, doesn't sound that ET either, because at that point he'd never seen a UFO. He never saw grays or anything like this. He would later see UFOs and have some really profound UFO-like dreams. But he also considered the possibility that this, well, later could be Bigfoot, which sounds crazy. Because, I mean, it's inside his house, for one thing. It's quite short. It reached up to the doorknob. And England is really, I mean, you might know better than me, but I don't believe you guys have a lot of Bigfoot there.
Not really. Depending on who you ask, the majority of people don't think there's much in it.
So I don't know, but he later picked up a book on Bigfoot and was shocked to see that what he saw looked very much like that. So maybe a baby Bigfoot. I'm not going to rule it out, but I can tell you, as unusual as this sounds, I do have other cases where Bigfoot have appeared in people's rooms and do exhibit sort of paranormal aspects in terms of walking through walls or turning invisible or being in places where they would never be expected. So I don't know. I'm not sure how to interpret that experience. Neither is he. But he would later have a very interesting ghostly encounter as well, not to mention a very poignant and profound encounter with what he believes is an angelic figure. So there's that high strangeness again. A lot of this stuff comes all together hand in hand. I'm not sure it's the same thing, but there's a weird connection there for sure.
It's almost as if that if you have an experience as a child, Preston, that it seems to open you up to all kinds of strange things that are going on around you that perhaps you didn't notice. So whether this is the catalyst for people to be more attuned to the world about them, to become more spiritual, or as some of the other witnesses and experiences have said, that they suddenly start to develop precognition, they have premonitions, they can sense things, they just know that the world isn't what they thought it used to be after they have these experiences as children, which I find an interesting concept. Are they chosen for that reason, that they have these abilities? Or is it just, this is just one of those things? Because I would imagine there's as many cases where child experiences do not go on to develop any kind of sort of paranormal skills.
Yeah, but that would be more the exception. And I think it's a two-way street. I do think that there's some evidence that they are attracted to people who have psychic abilities. Because we have people from very early childhood who are experiencing perhaps a near-death experience or a lot of psychic abilities. And then we'll later have encounters. But more often, it will be their encounters which seem to wake up their psychic abilities. And honestly, from having interviewed a lot of people, I think this is one of the ET agendas, one of their goals, their missions, is to wake us up to our own abilities. And I've got quite a few cases where ETs have told people that, like, you need to do this. Or we'll say something along the lines like, this is our gift to you for having worked with us. And so many contactees have the ability of mediumship or remote viewing or astral projection or something along these lines. Healing comes up quite a bit. So you can, explain this in different ways, but the facts are the facts. This is happening. And I can't believe that there's not a connection here because it's, like I said, it's more the rule than the exception. And that's why I really embrace that in this book so that the nuts and bolts crowd who are looking into this and trying to prove it can kind of move beyond that because I think we're there. I think we now have enough evidence to say that this is happening. And it's time for us to embrace the fact that it's more than just being pulled on board and physically examined. It's a lot more than that. There's a spiritual element to this that has been overlooked and shunted aside and ignored. And I think it's time that we stop doing that. This is an important part of this experience. And certainly the witnesses feel this way. It leads to what I would call a spiritual enlightenment, or certainly a degree of that. But absolutely, these contactees describe all kinds of abilities, I mean, even to the point of physical levitation. There's one case in the book where a girl levitated when she was just a tiny little baby. And I've run across this in other cases. I wrote an entire book about Dolly Safran and her experiences. She experienced levitation numerous times, not to mention a wide variety of psychic abilities. So yeah, that is something we need to accept that is part of this whole phenomenon.
Are you unsurprised that experiences doesn't seem to be part of the current mainstream UAP UFO conversation, Preston? Because I'm not.
I mean, I am and I'm not. I don't expect them. Having been in this field for so long and been disappointed and jaded and just frustrated to the nth degree with how this subject is being handled officially, I'm not the least bit surprised. I don't think we should expect them to tell the truth or be transparent or forthcoming on the subject. Because they're not, and they haven't been. So why would they ever change? Yes, we've had steps towards disclosure, but it's not disclosure. They haven't released the Roswell craft and the bodies or any really significant film that's absolutely incontrovertible. We're somewhat close to that, but we're not there yet. We have NASA saying, well, we need more information. And the Pentagon saying, well, we've got, 400 sightings now, but we're still not sure what this is. Sure you're not. I think that's disingenuous. I think that's a lie. And yeah, they're talking about sightings. Really? When we have thousands, not hundreds, thousands of landing trace cases, good hard physical evidence, implant removal cases, medical cases, electromagnetic effect cases. We have a wide variety of physical evidence to support all kinds of UFO encounters. Angel hair, which not a lot of people know about, but is a substance that reacts to UFOs or comes, well, we're not entirely sure what angel hair is or how it's formed, but in a number of encounters, this cotton candy spider web-like substance comes falling down, apparently as a reaction to the high plasmic fields surrounding craft. And that's been studied. They're not talking about that either. What's wrong with you? They should be bringing on Travis Walton, all Whitley Strieber, all the people who have been having encounters for years. They have yet to mention a single case involving a live humanoid or an onboard experience. They're not going to talk about Betty and Barney Hill or any, Calvin Parker and Charlie Hickson or any of these people. And that's such a shame because that is the heart of the UFO phenomena. That's where the answers are. That's certainly where I've concentrated my research because that's where I think, and that's the cutting edge, let's face it, of what's going on here. Direct contact. And they're doing their level best to ignore it officially, all our governments.
Are you, as we were saying, I think it's very interesting when we look around the world, Preston, how other countries seem to be far more forthcoming about this, because I'm wondering where they've drawn the line to say, well, this is where this thing started, because obviously we can go back decades, and there are numerous cases, even back to Project Blue Book, that they couldn't explain away or gave the most spurious explanations, as the running joke about swamp gas often comes up, the case that changed Hynek from skeptic to believer, and some of the excuses that have been passed over, Lonnie Zamora saw a NASA mooncraft being tested, being dangled from a helicopter, or people mistook a fuel plane refueling another plane, even though the guy that saw it used to work on them and said it definitely wasn't that. So are they just saying, well, this started 20 years ago, or are they just trying to? It's almost like they've got their finger in the dam, and they're desperately plugging that hole, even though everybody knows that. Where do they start with this? How far back are they going to ignore?
Well, they're doing 80 years, really, of research. And I love that analogy, the finger in the dam, because that's exactly how I look at it. It's a dam filled with truth. There are numerous holes in this dam. It's cracking. Let's face it, it's overflowing. And it's about to absolutely burst. And that is why I think we're seeing steps towards disclosure. It's not an effort at being truthful or transparent. It's an effort to release the pressure on this dam, control the narrative, and basically make themselves still relevant. Because our governments are now at a point where they're no longer credible in their explanations of this subject. Because the evidence is there. It's in the public arena. We have enough documented cases to absolutely prove this conclusively. They know it. We know it. They know we know. We know they know we know. I can go back and forth on this. But yeah, at some point, I think disclosure is inevitable because you can't hide the sky. You can distort the truth. You can hide it. You can try to explain it away, but you can never destroy it. The truth is indestructible because it is what it is. And sooner or later, it's going to come out because this is a real phenomenon. This is happening. We know this. And at some point, I think we're probably going to have open official contact. How this will roll out is anyone's guess, but it's really time for everyone to stop looking to our governments for answers. I honestly don't think any of them are ever going to be truthful or transparent. Not fully. I think we'll definitely have some major steps moving forward towards this, but I don't think we'll ever do it willingly. Let me underline that, voluntarily. They might have to do it because their hand is forced. I mean, that's what happened with the civil rights movement. This was not something our governments embraced. They had to because this was an idea whose time had come and nothing was going to stop it. So I feel like that's a good analogy for the whole UFO field. We'll see. I mean, there's so many whistleblowers now who are just itching to talk. And what I like about this is to prosecute a whistleblower is to admit to the veracity of their story. So this gives them a level of protection. And every UFO researcher out there worth their salt has received whistleblower accounts. Well, I won't say every, but You know what I mean? A lot.
Yeah.
I certainly have. And I know many others who have as well. Because there's a lot of people who are sitting on knowledge that they really want to share and do their part for disclosure. It's happening, you know, like it or not, we are not alone. I don't know what the resistance is to this phenomenon, other than our own governments have spent so much time and energy and done a really concerted and effective campaign to debunk this subject. That we're effectively brainwashed.
Yeah.
And all of humanity has embraced the lies that have been put forth by our governments for decades. And I'm here to say no more. Stop it. This is not the right decision. It just isn't. It's do the right thing. Don't lie. Tell the truth. It's not hard. It's easier than lying.
Sadly, it's not just this subject, is it, though, as you refer to it? It's often, as you mentioned there, the civil rights movement, the emancipation of women in life. Preston, these are things that they've had to do, not because they wanted to. It's because they had to do it. But they're always dressed up as, look what we've given you.
Yep. Yeah. This is one of the reasons why I don't trust our governments. And yeah, sadly, it's not just the UFO field, because I've certainly looked into it. And I've come to realize I am not so sure they have our best interests in mind. They're out for themselves. They want the money. This is one of the driving forces behind the cover-up. It's greed. It's power. It's control. But I feel like all humanity is a much greater force than the so-called cabal or the 1% or the Illuminati or the secret government, whatever you want to call it. Humanity is the one who is responsible for their own destiny. That's what the ETs said. You know, they're not going to step in and save everything. It's up to us to do it.
Yeah. Well, it's another wonderful collection. I can't wait to see what you turn your hand to next, Preston. So what's any insight into your next project?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I'm always working on something, Paul. You know it. probably my next book that I'm putting out will be Not From Here, Volume 5.
Ah, yes.
I've put out 4 volumes all about the more outlying types of cases. Cases showing weird patterns to UFO research, like, you know, UFOs over prisons or over graveyards or, you know, over mines, all kinds of mines, all different types of encounters. And I'm working on, another volume of that, perhaps another book about out-of-body experiences, some supernatural stuff. Definitely I want to put out a sequel to the book Symmetry, which is one of my most successful and I think really important books, because it lays it out in black and white what's going on. So yeah, I'm always keeping busy.
Fantastic. So where can everybody follow your work and get a hold of this book and all your previous publications, Preston?
I appreciate that. Yeah, thanks. My books are available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and other online retailers. You can also go to my website, or I'm all over social media, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. And certainly you can reach out to me through any one of those platforms. I'm pretty easy to find. If you just punch my name in, it should take you to all of those areas. And certainly I always enjoy hearing from people, even if you've just got a comment or a question, but especially if you've got a story to share. Because I'm always on the lookout for new information on this subject. But yeah, that's why I appreciate so much you having me on your show. It's an important subject. I think everyone who's in this field, I've got to give kudos to them, because you're fighting against the current. Even now we're seeing an effect, because the tides are turning and a lot of people are coming around and being drawn into this field. This is a new era. I think we're at a time which is different than it's ever been before.
Yeah.
But people are absolutely embracing this.
And long may it continue. Preston, it's always a pleasure. Thank you again for joining me and spending time in my company. As I said at the beginning, I always feel enriched and enlightened, and this is no disappointment as usual. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.